All right. So we didn't record this beforehand. So hello and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Chadbourne. With me, as always, is Thomas Brooks.
Hello, hello.
And we have two special guests, which we're going to get right into just about now. Yeah, I guess joining us with our discussion, where we're doing a summer discussion on psychology of religion, history of religious systems, and whatnot, are two special guests. We have with us Dr. Tracy Hindley and Dr. Matt Rosano. So first off, I want to thank you both for joining us to talk about some of your expertise regarding history of religious systems, evolutionary psych, and whatnot.
Well, good to be here.
So I guess usually what we start with is to have our guests kind of introduce themselves a little bit, tell us a little bit about kind of who you are, what you do, what you're interested in, if there's anything new that you're working on, you want to kind of clue everyone in on, anything like that, because usually our guests will do a better job of introducing themselves than we will. Well, who wants to go first?
Go ahead, Matt.
Okay, I'll go first. I'm Dr. Matt Rosano, and in about 30 days, I will be retired from Southeastern Louisiana University in Hammond, Louisiana. Been there for 30 years, and over the course of those 30 years, my research area has been the evolution of ritual, religion, a little bit of human consciousness and awareness, that sort of stuff. I was a cognitive psychologist by training in graduate school, but then not too long into my independent work, I retrained myself more or less as an evolutionary psychologist because that area became much more interesting, and I really wanted to get into it. And so I would say for the past 20 years or so, I've been an evolutionary psychologist more than a cognitive psychologist, using Darwinian principles to try to understand human nature and what it is that makes us human. And in the end of all of that, I concluded that what really makes us human is ritual. And so that's what I'll tell you about here in a little bit, I guess.
That's what we're eager to learn about, or learn more about.
And congrats on the retirement.
Thank you.
Well, Matt gave himself a very humble introduction. I will tell you that Matt is not just a national name, but a genuine big name internationally. He's probably the among the leading figures of evolutionary psychology, certainly within the context of ritual and in the context of religion. If folks in archaeology or anthropology want a kind of a psych perspective, him and I mean he's right up there with folks like Dunbar as who gets cited, who gets appealed to. So you've got a heavy hitter here when you've got Matt in the room. My name's Tracy Hindley, currently at TAMU Commerce, where I first met both Daniel and Thomas. Like Matt, and he and I are roughly of an age, I began as a cognitive psychologist, but my kind of second stream all my life was history and philosophy, and that's still largely what I do. The last 5 or 10 years, I also got very intrigued by kind of psychology and prehistory, as it were, evolutionary psych. Reached out and insinuated myself upon Matt, and that turned into a couple of nice collaborations. He and I were able to do a couple of books in that area. And while he swears it won't happen, I've not completely given up on us making that a trilogy, but we'll see.
Well, thanks for those kind words. That was very nice of you.
So I guess we should begin with a discussion on kind of some of the ritual practices. So some sort of early Homo sapiens, or I mean, I'm not sure what the literature currently says regarding other like hominid species. I think there seems to be something with Neanderthals. Thomas and I were talking about like a possible bear cult earlier, but again, like how much ritual, was involved with that, or were they just placing some bear skulls around? So I guess we should start with that. Like, can you give us a little bit of the background on like early hominid or Homo sapiens religious practices or ritual practices, spiritual practice?
Okay, well, I think the first thing we need to do is make a distinction between ritualized behavior and ritual. Because if we're going to talk about ritualized behavior, that has deep evolutionary roots. You can find ritualized behaviors in a wide range of different animals across the animal kingdom. But ritual and ritualized behavior aren't exactly the same thing. When you start to talk about ritual, you're adding some elements to it that pretty much, I would say, all animals other than humans would not have. I think ritual is uniquely human. Ritualized behavior, widespread. Ritual, uniquely human. So how do we define these things? Well, think of ritualized behavior as an ordinary behavior done in an extraordinary way. And when we take an ordinary gesture, an ordinary behavior, and we do it in an extraordinary way, we're doing things like exaggerating the gestures, exaggerating the motions, repeating the motions, repetition, exaggeration, stylization, intentionality. You're taking some kind of a behavior, some kind of a gesture, and you're doing it in a very deliberate, intentional, precise, maybe exaggerate that. You're really putting much more effort into the gesture than what you need to. And that immediately or usually is going to attract the attention of those who are observing the gesture. Now, that happens widespread across the animal kingdom. Think of mating rituals, waterfowl that do mating dances. Think of one of my favorites, which is the play bow, if you're a dog owner. You probably have seen the play bow numerous times from your dog when you go out throwing a frisbee or whatever you're going to do. And of course, all kinds of ritualized behaviors that our primate relatives use, grooming and bowing and begging and pant hooting and just all kinds of stuff that non-human primates will use to regulate their social behavior. And okay, so they're doing these exaggerated, intentional, repetitious, ritualized behaviors, and usually they're doing them in that extraordinary way because they're trying to send some kind of a social signal. There's a social signal, there's a message usually about their state of mind, about their intentions, and they need to get that message across clearly. So if you go back to the dogs and the play bow, a lot of the things that happen when canines roughhouse play is it's almost exactly like the stuff they do when they fight. They're going to chase each other, bite each other, growl at each other. And you need very clearly to send a message before you start doing all this stuff that, hey, my intention is to play, not to fight. Let's not let this get out of hand. And so that's what the ritualized behavior does in an effective way. It sends this message about intentions. Well, okay. So when does it become ritual? I would argue it becomes ritual when you start to, the messages that you're sending are more symbolic. They're on a much greater scale. An anthropologist, a guy named Ray Rappaport, argued that one of the things that ritual does, that ritualized behavior doesn't necessarily do, is it says something about how the individuals who are participating in the ritual activity, how they see the universe ordered. There's some kind of order to the universe as they see it, and their activity that they engage in, whatever it is, whatever kind of, you know, whether they're doing dancing around the fire or initiation ritual or something like that, they're also then communicating symbolically and in some kind of representational way the way they see the universe ordered, and therefore the kind of values that are important to their group and that they are obligated to follow. And so when you start adding that next part to it, what Rappaport referred to as the canonical message of the ritual activity, then I think you're getting into something that only humans can do. And when did our ancestors start doing that? That's a real good question. I would be inclined to argue it's probably not until rather later in evolutionary history, when we start to see things like cave art and we start to see evidence of ritual activity going on in cave settings that might be shamanistic in nature, maybe somewhere around 100,000 years ago, 70,000 years ago, or that sort of thing. How about if I stop there? I don't want to keep talking on and on and on, but there's our first important distinction. Ritualized behavior, something very widespread. Ritual, something more, much more restricted, I think, to just a Homo sapien or maybe a Neanderthal brain. I don't know. You were making reference earlier to the bear cult stuff. That's the stuff that they found at Brunekel Cave, which dates to about, I think we're dating it now to about 170,000 years ago. Where Neanderthals went into about 200 meters, I think so, deep into a cave in France, and they broke off all the, and I always get these terms confused, stalactites, stalagmites, the things that hang, the things that, they broke all that stuff off, or a lot of it, and they formed a couple of circles, and then they built a fire in one of the circles, and there's evidence of bear skulls, I think, and other bear bones and that kind of stuff, and some have argued that there may have been some kind of bear cult ritual activity in there. It's hard to say. Definitely there was deliberative behavior there somehow. Did the bear bones end up there later because bears went in there and died? It's hard to say, but it's possible.
Yeah.
I was going to ask about the evidence between cave art and bear bones and circles made out of stalactites. What is the evidence that evolutionary psychologists are typically looking at to find ritual behavior, and how do we measure that in terms of, like, was there ritual behavior here, was there not? Like, where did those tensions lie within the field of evidence?
Well, I think one of the things you do is you look at extant hunter-gatherers and you use them as something of a model. And where you see them creating the rock art or sometimes cave art, I suppose, but you see something analogous in hunter-gatherer activity. And then you also consider the fact that when, you know, we're at about 50,000 years ago, 30,000 years ago, when the evidence of cave art is starting to emerge, you have a brain in those Homo sapiens, which is really a human brain. And so if I'm looking at cave art, that cave art is, say, 30,000, 25,000 years ago, there's something in it that looks very similar to the kinds of cave art or the kinds of rock art that we know extant hunter-gatherers created. And we know that when those extant hunter-gatherers created that rock art, it was in association with shamanistic ritual activity or initiation rituals that they're engaging in. Well, that's fairly compelling. And our ancestors 30,000 years ago, 25,000 years ago, their brain was a human brain. Then you start to say, well, you know, we know that when humans do this kind of stuff, they do it because they're engaging in some kind of ritual activity. Of course, we can't know exactly what they were doing when they went into caves. But that argument by analogy becomes a fairly compelling argument. And then also when you start to look at the art and you see how really amazing it is, I mean, they put a tremendous amount of effort into it. And in some cases, they seem to be depicting shamanistic themes. There are shamanistic, what we know to be shamanistic themes present in some of it. And sometimes they're depicting what look to be not realistic animals, but things that look more imaginative. All of that starts to roll together, and you start to say, "Man, there's something going on here. This is high cost activity. This is activity that took time, effort, energy. There's imagination associated with it. This is the kind of stuff that if we did this today, we would say this is part of some kind of supernatural ritual activity." So I think that's probably the kind of argument that most folks have made to say, okay, definitely what we're looking at here is some kind of ritual action that was happening in this cave or, some other venue where we see the art and that sort of stuff.
Awesome. Thank you. In your distinction between and maybe Dr. Henley, you can help parse this apart, but the distinction between ritualized behavior and ritual almost exists separate to the belief structures of the people who engage in them. Is that helpful in a way to study ritual behavior, or is there some sort of like hierarchy of like the belief informing the ritual behavior? I'm thinking of like terror management theory, who argued that like depending on the belief system that exists, that does a better job of alleviating existential dread, essentially. Is that distinction ever made? Do we consider what those beliefs might have been? Or is the ritual behavior isolated from those beliefs something that's important for the research and for asking these kinds of questions?
I'm going to continue to defer to Matt. He has a book on religion. As such, you guys both know me, and I've done this a couple of times. I'm not shy, but this is another perfect Matt question because he is also an expert on the origins of religion. So,
well, after the answer, you take it where you want to take it, okay, Dr. Henley?
Okay, so if I understand your question correctly, you're asking about the beliefs that might have been motivating the ritual activity?
Yes. So what are the beliefs, and do they exist separate from the ritual? So does it matter what those beliefs are in order to get to the ritual, or do people do ritual just outside of religious contexts as well?
Okay. It's an interesting question, and I can attack it from different points of view. Let me start this way. I think ritual activity, or activity that is approaching what fits the definition of ritual, that's going to predate any kind of supernatural belief, especially if we're talking about supernatural belief, which is a fundamental part of religion. Imagine, go back 300,000 years ago, 400,000 years ago, just before Homo sapiens. And so we have Homo heidelbergensis, maybe some early forms of Neanderthals. Okay. Something happens. A big kill takes place. Okay. They kill something, a giraffe, a wildebeest, a woolly mammoth. That's going to create a state of elation, don't you think, amongst the group? I mean, they're just going to be happy as hell. They're going to eat well for the next, few days, week. And no question in my mind, they're going to start the fire. They're going to start dancing around the fire. They're going to start chanting. They're going to start doing all that sort of stuff. Well, as you do that stuff around a fire in the darkness with your friends, all moving in unison, you got all the chemicals that start to get the release, the dopamine, the endorphins. You get this state of joy. And if you keep doing it in this rhythmic way in front of the fire, you start to go into altered states of consciousness. You're going to start to have feelings and experiences that are going to convince you potentially that your dead relatives aren't necessarily dead. You see them in your state, in your altered state. You see them in dreams where they talk to you. You're going to go into the state that seems like something that goes above and beyond just the normal state of consciousness. Well, in that, and then later you're talking to your friends about it, maybe, and say, man, when we did that dance, that was, I felt a feeling that I've never felt before. Something more powerful than me touched me when we did this. So if you envision that kind of scenario, there you could make an argument. Belief is really arising from the ritual, right? The ritual is bringing about this altered state of consciousness. It's bringing about this level of feeling and joy that may be beyond the kind of expectation that these folks would have for their normal consciousness. And so, I would argue the origins of the supernatural start to come out of this intense ritual activity that brings on altered states of consciousness. And then, you also start to think about the brain as getting bigger. Homo heidelbergensis had a brain that was probably 80% of what the Homo sapiens brain is. So I'm sure they were dreaming. I'm sure in their dreams they were having visions. And all of this can rationally come together under the explanation of, there's more than just this physical material world around us. we sense this when we engage in certain kinds of ritual activity or when we go into certain altered states. Well, okay, if now you have the origins of some kind of supernatural belief coming out of this intense ritual activity, and you start to move forward, the brain starts to become larger, you eventually get to the human brain, and you start to have the logical, rational, more cognitive processes that can sort of put things together in a logical way. It doesn't seem to me it's too difficult where you start to come up with a story, a narrative. You know, what is this supernatural world? This supernatural world is where the ancestors exist. I know they still exist because I have dreams of my dead grandfather or whatever, and he's trying to tell me something. This supernatural world has power because, you know, where does the rain come from? Why do we have droughts sometime? You know, it helps to understand, helps them to understand the world potentially. And as this understanding of how the world works grows, then ritual starts to form itself in ways that are compatible with that. You know, you can sort of see the two things now starting to work in tandem where, hey, when we do our rituals, let's try to somehow form them, shape them so that they are more pleasing to the ancestors, so that they are sending a clearer message to the spirits about us and about our concerns. You know, please don't send a drought to us. We'll observe taboo, you know, be good to us. I think you can see these things then starting to evolve in tandem as our ancestors are trying to adapt and be more competitive, to be more effective in dealing with their world and in dealing with the environment that they're in.
So something that maybe we can get Matt to talk about a little bit more would be at least kind of the front end of Hayden's notion that there may be individuals who are kind of at a metacognitive level, understanding this and exploiting it. So why don't you walk them through that?
Well, yeah, that's the big man hypothesis that an archaeologist up in Canada, I think he is at, or maybe he's retired, Simon Fraser University sticks in my head. I think that's where Brian Hayden is or was. Yeah, Brian Hayden's done a fair amount of work looking at what he refers to as the big man. So suppose in your group, you have someone who is out in front in understanding this, putting together what you might call primitive theology of how the supernatural world works. And also, if this person is perfecting to a certain extent the ritual activities that give you access to the supernatural world, then this could be potentially a very important person in your group. And Hayden argues that the origins of a powerful shaman, the origins of some kind of chief in the tribe, this may come out of particular, rather egotistical, rather individuals within males in the group who want to dominate the reproductive potential of females in the group. And they start to use ritual and understand the supernatural as their mechanism for achieving a higher place in the hierarchy. You need to listen to me. You need to follow the kinds of ritual practices that I say, you know, need to be done. I have a certain kind of knowledge about ritual activity and about communicating with the ancestors that you don't have. And therefore, you need to cede a certain amount of power to me, or influence to me, that you don't to just the average person in the group. And he argues this is where the big man comes from. If the big man then is someone whose family, whose offspring, you know, continue down that line, you can have the sources of inequality with the group. And so you can have individuals in the group that form the line of chiefs or form the line of the priests or the shamans within the group. And so he argues a lot of innovation in ritual practice and in ritual activity and in the understanding of the supernatural comes out of these big men as they're trying to usurp power for themselves. A lot of innovation, but then also a lot of inequality and a lot of oppression of other members of the group. So he has a nice example of how the supernatural can be used in a way that is rather nefarious. Whereas you can have other examples of where the supernatural can be used in ways that are more benign, you might say, and helping just to create group unity, helping individuals within the group put aside selfish interests and put group interests in front of them. So, you know, just like religion today, there it is, and it can be the source of a great deal of good, and it can also be the source of some rather nasty stuff as well.
So that kind of gets us to like talking about kind of like the adaptive function of ritual. And so like we kind of start with these ritual behaviors, and then in order to kind of explain what's going on when we're engaging in these altered states of consciousness, when we start engaging from ritual behavior, we start to do it purposefully. And then that can kind of evolve into very maybe specific types of ritual. And so, you know, if something bad happens, we go, oh, okay, you know, the moon was red at the time, and so we need to do this thing before we go out and do anything, because it's bad luck, so we have to perform this ritual to better help as a way to explain. And then we kind of move into these potential adaptations. So like on one hand, like what Thomas brought up, as a way to reduce like terror, you know, terror management, so to deal with that, those existential threats, we engage in ritual to feel better about them. Or like where you're getting at, where you have some people who are trying to benefit group cooperation versus selfishness, using ritual or using kind of the supernatural belief as a tool to gain their own adaptive, you know, they get adaptive fitness and they get to pass on their genes as a part of that. So like what other maybe examples are we getting at? I remember, if I'm going back to my evolutionary psychology lessons, getting into things like how ritual behavior and ritual may have benefited us in like childbirth ritual, or you know, again to help and aid with healing, as these like potential adaptive behaviors, which would have then made those who could engage in ritual benefit from it, to be the ones who survive versus those who couldn't. And I guess could either of you maybe dive in a little bit or offer some examples regarding some of those rituals that act as adaptive traits, or how ritual could be utilized as an adaptive trait from an evolutionary perspective?
Well, before I start running off at the mouth for another 15 or 20 minutes, I feel like I should step back and let Tracy say something if he wants before I start into things. So I'll pause for a moment.
Well, again, and not known for my humility, but, you know, Matt has the article there in Psych Review, Psych Bulletin on this exact topic. And again, it's probably the most cited thing on this matter. So you do have the guru, the expert here. I'm curious to know what example you will draw on, actually, though. I am curious.
Well, Daniel raised a number of things there. And there's a number of levels at which I think ritual acts in an adaptive way. Okay, so level number one, group cohesion. If you go back into our evolutionary past, you're going to reach a point where Homo sapiens, well, certainly by the time we get to Homo sapiens, even before that, with say Narokotomi Boy and the forms of Homo ergaster, Homo erectus, you now have a species that is much more human-like than ape-like. Which we all look at and we go, oh, man, that's wonderful. I mean, they got a big brain and they've lost a lot of that hair and now they're really looking like a human. And that's just fantastic. Hell no, it's not fantastic. You now have a species. You now have a creature that no canine teeth for any, you know, reasonable, for any useful purposes. Can't run very fast, but it's on the ground. But it's certainly not going to outrun predators. It's weak. It can't fly. It can't swim very well. It can't climb trees very well. This thing has no chance to survive when there are, you know, saber-toothed tigers around and, you know, all the hyenas and whatever else been around there. Okay, what's the one chance? Why were they successful? What's the one chance they have?
They were smart.
They can work together as a group. Like no other species on Earth, okay? How do you get them to work together? How do you get them to form that sort of competitive community where they have each other's backs? They're willing to sacrifice for each other. They're willing to work complementary with each other. You do this, I'll do that. Protect each other. Yeah, ritual is the answer. Ritual is what we use to bind groups together, to get groups to be complement, you know, get the individuals in the group to complement each other, to back up each other, compensate for each other's weaknesses. You know, one person can do this very well. The other person can do that very well. If we get together, we can be very effective. So the first thing you have then is you have ritual as this mechanism for group bonding, so that you have a very cohesive group. You have a group that works together well. You have a group that can work as a team, and as a team, with rocks and projectiles and other sorts of things, they can chase off hyenas and therefore steal the kill from them. No other species is going to be able to do that. So there you have number one. And also, I've made an argument in a couple of different places where I really think it was ritual activity that made the difference between Homo sapiens and Neanderthals. We engaged in much more ritual activity, much more high-cost ritual activity, and therefore, when we started marching into Europe, and even though that was Neanderthal home territory, you know, the analogy I like to use is we were like Marines marching in against hippies. We were so well coordinated, and we worked together so well, and we were willing to sacrifice for each other in ways that the Neanderthals just simply couldn't match in any way. How do you do that? Ritual activity does that. Okay, so there's number one. You mentioned childbirth and healing. Well, that starts to get into this altered state that can be brought on by ritual activity. The relaxation that occurs when you start to monitor your breathing or you start to dance rhythmically with others around a fire, the endorphins that get released. One of the things we know about ritual activity, it can bring on a state of relaxation. Alert relaxation. It can relieve anxiety. It can increase pain tolerance. Well, all of these things would have been essential in an ancestral world where you have some herbs and you have some, you know, remedies that you can use from the jungle. But other than that, you know, that's the extent of your health care. The extent of your health care is going to be the placebo effect that you can get from ritual activity. And so, yeah, in childbirth, how are you going to do this? Well, you know, when we look at traditional hunter-gatherers, it's hard to find a traditional society that doesn't have all kinds of ritual that's associated and taboos that are associated with pregnancy and childbirth and that sort of thing. Yeah, that was the mechanism for helping a woman get through the ordeals of childbirth. Okay, so you have that. You have... also, then, if you are going into that altered state, and if you have a shaman who you believe very strongly has this connection to supernatural power, and so being with the shaman, going through the rituals with the shaman, believing that the shaman has power, that creates the conditions for placebo healing. You know, even separate from childbirth, just from injuries that you might encounter and all of those sorts of vagaries that happen when you're living, you know, running around out in the jungle. So you've got benefits both at the group level, group cohesion. You've got benefits at the individual level, relaxation, relieving anxiety, increase immune system function. You've got healing benefits. You've got benefits at all these different levels that ritual would have engendered or endowed on our ancestors. And so it makes a lot of sense to me, as I look at evolutionary history, that those of our ancestors that were more capable at ritual and groups that were more effective in harnessing the power of ritual, they would have had an advantage over groups that were less competent when it comes to ritual activity. And so this is part of the argument I make about how ritual made us human. We're here talking about this. Neanderthals aren't, because our ancestors were really good at ritual and reaping the benefits of ritual.
So now we have, we'll take the childbirth example, in that we have medications, institutionalization, actual medications to help with childbirth. What areas do you see now where we're still engaging in ritual behavior and reaping those benefits that you discussed for like prehistory? Are we still doing that? Has it been watered down in your opinion? Are we still a ritualistic society in any way?
Tracy, you want to do anything on that before I start talking?
Absolutely. Because we may have to line up here. We didn't rehearse this or plot in advance. But I was going to prod you with a similar question to the one that Thomas just asked, because I guess something that it dawned on me at some point that we hadn't done is to talk about the fact that ritual is still alive and well, that we do still see ritual And I'm sure we see it in the healthcare industry. I'm sure we still see it even in the context of childbirth. But we see it in sports. We see it in our dating and mating rituals, as it were. We see it in all kinds of places, even beyond where we might imagine that it still exists, which would be in religion. I think that increasingly we're seeing it a great deal in the context of political ideation and political practices. I think those potentially are becoming even more ritualized. So, at least from my take, which maybe is a little more sociological than psychological on this matter, but ritual seems to be something that is just as ubiquitous here in 2022 as it was in, 2022 BC. I'll stop with that.
Interesting. I understand what you're saying. I think you can look and you can find examples of what we would potentially call ritual going on in a lot of different situations and circumstances. However, I'm nowhere near as positive or optimistic about ritual in the modern world compared to what it was in the past. Take childbirth, for example. The medicalization of childbirth, especially in the West, really took a lot of the ritual practices out of it, I would argue, made it very cold and clinical. And I think there's been a pushback against that, say, in the past 20 years or so, and in Western medicine in total. I think you saw a sidelining of ritual because it didn't fit the double-blind gold standard of medical research of what is really effective for bringing about healing and that sort of thing. And I think, again, it's only been rather recently, maybe in the last 15 years or so, that you started to see more research coming out saying, well, wait a minute, this placebo effect, it isn't something that we should avoid. It isn't something that we should try to get out of our medicine. All the experiments, we're always, okay, we have to make sure that this medical treatment actually has an effect, and it's not just a placebo effect. And therefore, the placebo was something we were trying to eliminate. It was disrespected, you might say. Now I think you're starting to see something coming back. Say, wait a minute, there's something to this placebo effect. There's something to the comforting, confidence-building ritual activities that the shaman used to do. Now we don't need to bring shamans back into a hospital room or something like that, but we do need to somehow bring back ritual practices that are building that confidence and that state of relaxation that was effectively part of the placebo effect.
I guess I genuinely have a question here of maybe the idea of what counts as a ritual has evolved, because my sense is that both what the mother does, the father does, the doctor, the nurses do is highly consistent. And maybe that's not enough for it to be ritual, but I think there are points at which we go to the hospital, then there are things we do at the hospital. There's an interaction with the doctor and kind of the option for pain medicines and episiotomies, and they're all played out in, unless there's a complication, unless there's some unique event, that are played out in this very very systematic from case to case way. And then, you know, what happens when the baby comes out, what is done to the baby to prepare it, when it's given to the mother, when and how it's swaddled, when it's taken away from the mother, when the father can see it, when it's safe to bring out a cigar, what color cigar that might be. I think, again, that there's a tremendous amount of consistency in these. But maybe what I'm hearing you say is that's no longer ritual, just because you get this consistency across cases.
Well, okay. Another important distinction we need to make is between ritual and routine. And I would agree that there are a lot of routines and procedures, you might say, that are associated with medicine and with a lot of other, you know, the pilot in the cockpit, all kinds of routine that they're going through. Let me put it this way. If I want to get really to the core of the argument that I would make, that ritual, I see lots of routines. I see lots of things that superficially on the outside look like ritual, like the stuff you were talking about at football games and athletic events and all that sort of stuff. However, the core of what our ancestors did that really made it ritual was this canonical function. Our rituals aren't just these procedures that we go through. We go through these procedures because these procedures reinforce and reflect how we see the universe ordered and our place in the universe. I think that's one of the big things that ritual always did for our ancestors. It told them, this is how we see the world, and this is how we see our place in the world. And therefore, it gives us a purpose. It tells us what our purpose in life is. And I would argue that is what's missing. When you go through all the right procedures and routines in the hospital, that's wonderful. It's good. You should do it. But I don't think it tells you what your purpose in life is. Whereas the ritual activity of hunter-gatherers surrounding childbirth and pregnancy, they would tell you that. They would say, what you are doing for your tribe, for your ancestors, this is the most important thing you could possibly be doing. This is the meaning of your life. That is lost, I think. And I don't think that's there in political rituals. I don't think it's there in sports rituals. I think we have a lot of things that look ritualistic on the outside, but they don't have that same heart and soul, you might say, that tells people, this is why I'm here, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And one of the things I'd point to reinforce that a little bit, is if you look at polls and studies and all that kinds of stuff, you know, people in Western Europe and a lot of people in the United States, they'll say they're very happy. They'll also say they don't have a whole lot of meaning in their lives, which is a strange paradox. But it's exactly the paradox I would expect if in your day-to-day functioning, you're safe, you're happy, you're well-fed. But when you're laying in bed at night, you're going, is this it? is this all there is? And I don't think our ancestors had that existential problem. And if you look at the rates of suicide, you look at the rates of people using antidepressants, we have got to have right now, with whatever generation this is, Generation Z or B or whatever it is, they have to be the most messed up kids. I mean, everything I tend to see when, you know, I look at data and kids today, especially in the United States, are just absolutely messed up. And as a hypothesis, I would say one of the reasons why they're really messed up is you don't have that really deep, all-encompassing kind of ritual as a daily part of life that reinforces this is who I am, this is my identity, this is my purpose, I have a reason for being here. And I think that's one of the things that it's the modern paradox dilemma or whatever you want to call it.
I absolutely follow that, and I wouldn't argue with it. I suppose I'm a little, again, I'm not sure exactly how this became positive, negative, but I guess I'm a little more bullish that I think we do, we get at least shards, chunks, small drops and tastes of that in some of our sports rituals and in some of our other rituals it does give us a sense of solidarity, a sense that, that it matters for me to be here now, or that, you know, I have allegiance with these folks in politics and all. But I don't disagree with you. But then let me spin it around and ask it this way. Do you think that we started losing the powerful sense of ritual that you're alluding to at the Neolithic Revolution, or do you think it was some point later? When did we start losing out on this powerful sense of ritual?
Whenever it was that individual autonomy became the highest value, or became one of the highest values in human life. And really, that idea of individual autonomy being one of the highest values, I think in many ways that's far more a Western problem than it is in many other parts of the world. Now, I can't pinpoint exactly when that happened. Maybe the Renaissance, maybe when you're coming out of that point of whenever it was, when some of those Renaissance humanism philosophers, as I'm recalling, that were talking about the subjective experience of religion is more important than the communal activity. And there was much more emphasis on the individual.
Just go ahead and say it. You're blaming Martin Luther.
Well, certainly there was a contribution there, but the winds were blowing that direction probably before him. But I think that's, you know, when you start to say the individual creates his or her own meaning in life, good luck. You know, that's what the West has been trying to do and been trying to say. And look, there's a lot. I would rather be living in the modern time in the modern West than anywhere else. Okay, I mean, I'm not saying we should go back to hunter-gatherer days. But I am saying it's healthy, really healthy, for humans to have their identity wrapped up with a community, with a highly interconnected community, where a big part of their identity is being part of this community, a contributor to this community, and that community sees the universe in a certain way and helps that individual then have purpose. Last time I checked, some of the lowest rates of depression, anxiety, and all this kind of stuff were in the Amish and in Orthodox Jews and in these groups that still have this very clear sense of who they are and what the purpose of their life is. Now, those groups have other problems, but they don't tend to have the same high rates of the modern problems, substance abuse and depression and all this other stuff that seems to be an epidemic in many places in the West right now.
It makes me think, because I mean, part of what Tracy was getting at with the idea of like people tying their identity to politics or whatnot is a way in which kind of see individuals kind of create these communal shared belief system, but it's more ritual behavior, not ritual. Kind of getting at their kind of going through the motions and engaging in maybe shared language or chanting. I think about this a lot as kind of a core thesis with a lot of the fan research that I've been doing. So you have these highly cohesive, highly connected fan communities who engage in shared watching of material, shared creation of art and music and whatnot. And through that identity are able to benefit from it and find purpose and meaning through positive moral messaging in the show that they're watching, maybe Star Trek morals or something like that. But is it ritual?
It works for you.
Yeah, but is it ritual, I guess, is a big question with that, because they're not engaging in the same kind of communal ritual behavior that you would find in like the middle of a Christian mass or in these kind of shared experiences that have the potential for altered states of consciousness. With, I would maybe argue, the exception of when you get to like a fan convention and there's this like energy in the air and these people are engaging in like dance and conversation and this kind of shared interconnection as a close-knit group. But even then, it's like, I don't know if you call that ritual, but it's maybe ritual-like.
Yeah. I would also wonder to what extent they're willing to sacrifice for each other. If you have a very tight-knit group, yeah, they're going to sacrifice for each other. They're going to, money, time, effort.
And these groups that we look at.
Can the Star Trek community do that as well? I'm not so sure. If I was part of the Star Trek community and one of the members of the community said, hey, a couple thousand to help me through, I'm like,
but
I'm not sure.
But you say that our research does identify that they're, especially the stigmatized ones, are more likely to engage in charitable behavior to help other group members. They'll give time, they'll give money. Okay. Someone goes online and says, I'm having this issue. Other members of the group, and not everyone in the group, but other members of the group will step up and say, hey, we're here to help, or I'm here to talk, or like, let's work through these issues. There does seem to be some self-sacrifice, at least in some of these highly cohesive, maybe Star Trek fans, like there's too many. It's too easy to be a Star Trek fan when there's just so much Star Trek out there. But these like more niche fan communities we start to see. And maybe that's part of it too. Like we get to such a heightened level of population size that individual focus becomes a little easier because it's hard to keep up with millions of people in your community.
Well, yeah. One of the things we haven't touched on too much is ritual cost. And so the costlier it is to be part of the group, the more likely you're going to have a cohesive group that really does stand up for each other. The easier it is to be part of the group, the less likely they're going to be so emotionally connected to each other that they're willing to sacrifice.
I don't know, modern society might be why we see it in stigmatized fan communities over, because like there's that stigma associated with being part of that group. It's harder psychologically, yeah, than like, everyone's, anyone could be a Star Trek fan, Star Wars fan. It's popular now. Well, we're hitting about an hour. So I guess, are there any final thoughts? Anything to add?
I do have our two traditional questions. Well, I have our traditional question, and then I have a follow-up to ask both of our guests, if that's cool. The first one being, is exciting about the field of evolutionary psych and or cognitive archaeology that y'all see developing right now? Like, I think the typical question we ask is, what do you see the dissertations on in like 7 years that will be in this field? And then the second one is, both of y'all mentioned that you were trained in one area of psychology and then moved into this field on your own. How does one do that? I'm thinking, I have an idea, but just for like, since our audience is mostly undergraduates who are like, oh Lord, I have to commit to a subfield of psychology in my grad program. How do you keep those doors flexible between subfields?
Yeah, I don't know that Matt and I did it the same way, but I don't know that we didn't. Again, when I was going through school, you absolutely had to have an empirical research agenda. And so I went through a cognitive and experimental psychology, and then I guess subdivision of that cognitive and subdivision of that. I did essentially language stuff. Matt had thrown out earlier kind of reasoning by analogy. My dissertation was 7 different empirical studies on analogical reasoning. You know, that was the kind of thing that I did. You could call it psycholinguistics. You could call it maybe social cognition. But in addition to that, that doesn't preclude you from having interests that you are serious and sincere about, and that you are just as engaged in as those empirical interests. I had a master's in philosophy. I was always interested in the history of psychology. That just wasn't an empirical area. But there were a couple of journals. They're still there. There's one called APA has a journal called the History of Psychology. There's another big one that's interdisciplinary called the Journal for the History of Behavioral Sciences. And so in the same way that I would read cognitive science and cognitive psychology, at least flip through and see what the new articles were each time an issue came out of that, I would stay abreast of what was going on in history of psychology, and so continued to do my due diligence in terms of staying current in the literature. When I would go back in those days to things like APA, I would go to those divisions as well as the ones that did experimental psych. So, I mean, I think it's just a matter of paying your dues and being sincere and doing what you need to do to stay current and abreast. With respect to kind of the cognitive archaeology thing, again, it happened to me a little later than it happened with Matt, maybe a decade or so ago. And I remember Matt was one of the first people I reached out to about this. And I remember even talking with Matt about this in the room I'm sitting in now here in my house how do you establish bona fides? How do you get a foot in this door in a way that is kind of humble and appropriate? You know, I had some ideas. I knew I was just smart enough that I can read a journal article and for this kind of material, it's not kind of rocket science in the sense that it's not over your head. I can follow those arguments. I can read all that. But I also understood that there's a community, there's a socialization. There are these things that I was not part of, you know, having not been trained either as an archaeologist or even evolutionary psychologist. And so I do think that there's an art, and people like Matt are able to advise me and help me on how to get in without seeming to be a bull in a china shop or coming across as arrogant or inappropriate. So that was my experience.
Okay, so you had one part about what's exciting. And then another part about how do you switch gears in the middle of your career, that sort of thing. So what's exciting? I think the emergence of cognitive archaeology and the fact that we're more and more getting archaeologists and psychologists to communicate with each other and talk with each other. The couple of volumes that Tracy was really the main catalyst on, and then I tagged along to help with it, do a little editing. I'm really proud of those things. Those are nice compilations of archaeologists and psychologists coming together and talking to each other and trying to find some kind of interconnections. So I think that's really exciting. So that all starts to emerge, and that's exactly when I say, I'm getting the hell out of here. I'm going to retire. I'm tired of this stuff. So, but that's nice, because then it leaves room for others to come in. You know, it's like what Pete Townsend said, it's time for us to get out of the way, you know, the Who, and let the other bands come in. So that's okay. So I think that's part of the exciting thing. Now, how do you switch gears? Yeah, with me, it was a more, I think of it as a more natural process. I was studying spatial cognition, how people understand the layout of a space. And as I did empirical work in that, more and more, I started in my own thinking, you know, well, the reason why we understand the space that we're in the way we do is because of the evolution of our visual system, the evolution of our mind. And our minds tend to process space in a way different from other creatures because, and so those naturally got me into evolutionary history. And once I started getting into it, I said, this is cool. You know, I mean, this is that, you know, this potentially provides a larger, allows me to address larger questions, and ultimately questions of, you know, how is it that the human mind is different from other minds? What makes us unique as a species? Well, okay, to make the switch, I just had to read a lot of stuff. I mean, that's what you end up doing. You know, I end up looking at the reference list of articles that I'm reading, finding the books that everybody is citing, and okay, I got to go get that book and read it, because that's what everybody's citing. That's the one of, at least one of the sources of knowledge that everybody's drawing on. You know, and as you get into it more, as you start reading the stuff more and more, you get more acquainted with the jargon, you get more acquainted with the issues. And then I was also a bit lucky in the sense that one of my articles that I wrote attracted the attention of a couple of guys that were some of the leading guys in the field. And when I started communicating with them, they proved to be a real great source of information and of helping me understand how to communicate with archaeologists in an effective way. And I would never recommend anybody trying to come into archaeologists hate each other. I mean, they, you know, you read one article by one archaeologist who says, you know, X, Y, and Z, this is the way it is. And then you find a couple others that say, that's crazy. That's stupid. That's, you know, that's absolutely, you know, and it's really tricky that you don't want to end up putting yourself on one side against another side, especially as an outsider. So that, you know, I had to tread kind of carefully through that sort of stuff. But that's what you do. If you're going to, follow your interests, you know, follow the questions that are coming up in your research. And if you start to find there are certain questions that you really find interesting, and there's an area of psychology that is addressing those questions more directly, just start reading all the stuff. Read what they're saying, read how they're doing their work, you know, read what the issues are, get yourself up to speed, and then you can start thinking about it and maybe start making some contribution to it. First time you do it, you know, first articles you write, they're probably going to get rejected. But you look at the reviews and you say, okay, what is it that I missed here? You know, what stupid mistake did I make that I'm going to make sure I don't make the second time? And it takes a little time, but you know, if you stick with it, it's like anything, eventually you start to get a feel for what you're doing, and you get your feet a little more set, and you're able to do things more successfully.
I had a feeling the advice was just read all of it.
Hey, that is a big part of it.
Yep.
You know, when my kids ask me, your undergraduate training do for you? I said, the only thing that my BA degree did for me, and the only thing that any BA degree is really going to do for you, teach you how to read a book. That's it. If you get you get a BA and you understand how to read a book, critically read a book, be able to extract the major points out of the book, be able to understand the weaknesses, you're set. Because you're not going to know anything with a BA.
Yep.
Well, I realize we're out of time, but one of these days maybe we can get back together and sing lamentations over how reading seems to be a lost art among people even pursuing a BA. It's scary how much pushback I get when I try to get people to read.
We did read a lot in your class, though.
Which I appreciate now.
Yes.
Now.
But did not at the time.
Yep. I bet Newt's got big reading lists too. I bet that's not just me.
I mean, I took your lessons, and all my classes have massive reading lists now. So I'm already getting emails of students like, "Hey, do we have to read everything that you posted?" And I'm like, "Well, I posted it for a reason." Yes.
Hey, but I'll tell you something. When you're doing reading like I was doing to get indoctrinated into a new area, it's reading you enjoy, which I think is a lot different from a lot of the reading you have to do when you're in graduate school. I mean, there you're being forced to read stuff. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was fascinating to be able to learn this new area and become acquainted with it. So that's one of the things that makes it easier. You're reading stuff that you really want to read. You're motivated to read it.
Mm-hmm. I will say, I never really lamented any of the readings I had to do for either of your courses. I really enjoy cognitive psychology, really enjoy history of psychology, and I appreciate it a lot more now than I did maybe at the time. But yeah. So I guess with that, we'll thank you both for joining us. We can kind of conclude, say goodbye to any listeners once this is published.
Yes, thank you all so much for coming on and educating us about ritual. I'm always very excited to bounce out of my little window of psychology and learn more.
Okay, Daniel, Thomas, great meeting you. Well, Daniel, I know him, but great meeting you, Thomas.
Good to meet you.
And Tracy, continued good health, man. Take care of yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt. Before you leave the country, we should have another chit-chat ourselves. See you guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you. All right. So now to record the end.
Yes.
Because I didn't cover it because we kind of went two time. Our ism of the week. And as I say that, I realized I closed the window.
No! Close the windowism. Is that our ism of the week?
Close the windowism. Oh, no, because it's an ism that I recently learned about. Because I spent my entire day delving into the history of Northern New Mexico, controversial religious and political systems. There we go. All right. So I'm going to restart this with our ism or tradition of the week. So our tradition of the week is the Hermanos Penitentes, the Penitent Brothers of Colorado and Northern New Mexico. And they're a fascinating group because they kind of splintered away from the Catholic Church. But they have their roots in like early Spanish settlers or early Catholic missionaries. Only up until recently, they were male only. So only men could be penitent brothers. They did eventually start letting women and children into like subgroups, but they're not very prolific. So this is predominantly male. And I'm using this article from the Denver Public Library that talks about them because I'm going to link it into the information. But it wasn't really looked at positively by outsiders. Definitely wasn't looked at positively by the Catholic Church, who had like Catholic priests come into the community and they were like, these people are doing their own thing. Like they're holding their own masses. Like we can't get them into the church. Heretics. But they're predominantly known because they would, on like private land, like a rancher or someone else kind of out of town, would build this structure. And in the structure, they would basically create an altar. And then they would go out and run their rituals and their masses at like night. And so they're very kind of secretive. It's a little less secretive. Like they were done in public and then they became secret. And then they're a little less secret now. But it's not something you can just like go and find and hop into. And they have kind of exceptional ritual during Holy Week. And if you're in New Mexico and you've ever seen anyone walking down the road from point A to point B with like a cross, during Holy Week, they publicly whip themselves with whips made from yucca stalks or yucca stalks. They bound bundles of cacti to their bare backs or bound to heavy wooden crosses as they walk with the crosses through the stations of the cross. As for rituals that went behind closed doors, it's very hit and miss that we get any information on this. Let's see. It says that a novice received 3 Ave Maria cuts on his back to show that he was a genuine penitente. A man who had wronged his family, community, or fellow penitentes might receive a flogging or be made to crawl back and forth with bare hands and knees on pebbles and stones. And they're just super secretive. Apparently, there were also a source of clout and political power for Hispanics at the time in northern New Mexico and Colorado. In the Southwest, they faced pressure and discrimination from outsiders. Protestant ministers in the San Luis Valley saw penitentes as rivals for church membership. And also, they dealt with the fact that newcomers coming into their lands like wanted their lands to settle. And so they came into conflict with white immigrants to the country. It's still kind of, you know, something of a contentious nature when we look at kind of the history of both religious and political systems in northern New Mexico. So, speaking of ritual behavior.
Yeah, those sound like costly rituals.
Very costly rituals. And they still exist to some level today, maybe? Maybe?
Maybe?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that's our religious tradition of the week, the penitentes.
Very cool. Nice find.
Yeah. Yeah. It was an interesting delve. So with that, we will once again say goodbye.
Goodbye.